You are listening to the cycling podcast at the Giro d'Italia in association with Rafa, the fastest clothing in the world tour, the home of cycling with character. Ride and watch with Rafa in 2019 as they partner with EF Education First and Canyon SRAM.
Where are we, Daniel?
Well, Rich, we're in a quite spectacular location. We're above, a long way above the Lago di Zeo, which is near tomorrow's start in Lovere.
It's stunning, isn't it? The hotel is the Hotel Panoramico, which is an appropriate name. It's been a miserable day today, raining most of the day, but it stopped raining. The clouds are just sort of hanging there, and it's stunningly beautiful. Really still, isn't it?
Yep, we're above the clouds, aren't we? We're above some clouds, sort of tippy-tappy little wispy bits of cloud.
Like Marco Pantani's hair before he shaved it off.
Yeah.
There's a hot tub over there. We were tempted to podcast in the hot tub, weren't
yeah,
we?
Yeah, and we were trying to think to ourselves, what would Lionel do if he was here? He'd be in the hot tub with a lovely glass of pink Prosecco.
We've got cats crawling all over us here, but that's fine. I can't actually sit on my chair probably because of a cat. That's all right. That's fine. That's cats for you, isn't it? Anyway, Daniel, it's a rest day. It's the second rest day. Race resumes tomorrow, of course, with the mountains again. And what have we done today?
Well, Rich, there were a few press conferences, weren't there? The teams were a little bit unfortunate today in that most of them seem to be in hotels in the sort of suburbs of Bergamo. Bergamo is a gorgeous city, sort of a city of two halves, the newer lower half, but it's all relative. It's not that new, the lower half. It's quite beautiful. But the Città Alta, the high town, is very, very beautiful. And people might be familiar with that from Tour of Lombardy. The race kind of snakes around the high town, the old town. However,
not a great place to drive in a Maserati, is it?
Not a great place to drive in a Maserati. And most of the teams were neither in the high town, the low town. They were in the grotty suburbs.
The burbs.
And in particular, Jumbo-Visma were in a place called Zingonia, which is infamous. It's kind of the northern Italian equivalent of Moss Side or Compton if you're from LA.
Yeah, it was at least they had quite a nice hotel. Earlier we'd been in the Bora Hansgrohe CCC hotel, and it was a strange motel, an Italian motel without any kind of hotel reception or lobby or sort of communal areas, just really rooms. And it was the fact it was chucking it down the rain meant the riders couldn't even go out on their bikes. They were doing their recovery rides on turbo trainers set up on the sort of just under the cover of the.
Mattia Catania has taken a shining to you.
Yeah, you like me, don't you? That's fine. I think he's just trying to get at the crisps. However, anyway, no, it was. You do see that. That some of them draw the short straw on rest days like today.
Well, I'm Rich. We think, although the stage start has been moved,
if they could see us. Eh? Well, yeah, I mean, really.
Well, if the stage start has been moved back a bit tomorrow, it's a bit later than it should have been. Nonetheless, I think it's going to be a pretty early wake up for the riders tomorrow. I can imagine they'll be shoveling pasta in at about 7 o'clock tomorrow morning, maybe even earlier in some cases.
Well, this is our press conference, rest day press conference. We were at, as you said, a press conference. Oh well, there go the crisps. Enjoy them, Moggy. And we were at the Jumbo-Visma press conference was. Can you hear that? Oi, we're recording here. Don't be crunch crisps.
We'll be reporting him to Gianni Savio tomorrow morning, Matteo Catania.
Oh dear, oh dear. Anyway, it's probably good that we don't eat those crisps anyway. We were at Jumbo-Visma, Daniel, and a bit of news to follow up on from yesterday. There was what are we calling it? Urinegate?
Well, I don't know. It wouldn't be a grand tour without a Dutch sort of
Dutch related natural break related
toilet related controversy.
Actually, I was thinking about this. So there's a long history in the Giro of urinating. having some kind of effect on the racing. 1957, very famous case involving Charlie Gall and Louis Mbobe.
Yeah, correct.
Now, we covered this in a Kilometre Zero a couple of years ago, but the story was that Louis Mbobe stopped for a pee. Charlie Gall also stopped for a pee, thinking he was safe to do so. It was an ambush, a trap. Luis and Bobby didn't need a pee after all. And as soon as Charlie Gall stopped and began his business, Luis and Bobby took off. And I think thereafter, Charlie Gall was known as Monsieur Pee-Pee. Gall was furious at that, Giro said, I'll make sausage meat of you to Bobby at the finish. Anyway, enough of the 1957 Giro. The 2019 Giro is coming to the boil very nicely. And yeah, there was the story to follow up on where the Jumbo-Visma car was stuck quite a long way behind because they had stopped to answer a call of nature. And it meant that when Primoz Roglic had a problem with his bike, the car was nowhere to be seen. He had to take Antoine Tolhoek's bike, and he lost a bit of time. Not as much as he could have lost, but it was a bit of a disaster for Jumbo-Visma. I mean, not a disaster, but it's not a great day for them.
And it was, well, the source of some sort of innuendo, a bit of mischief from La Gazzetta dello Sport this morning. They were asking, well, they asked several rhetorical questions, among them, where did Roglic's second bike go, or the one that he...
The original one.
Well, the original one, because they claimed that the second team car hadn't showed up at the finish, and they were sort of suggesting, I don't really know what they were suggesting, whether they were suggesting it had been hidden, because there was...
A motor
inside. I think that was the inference.
I mean, that's what people say when people have bike changes and the first bike appears to go missing. We don't know if it did go missing.
Well, anyway, Rich, we tried to get a bit of clarity on that issue, didn't we? I spoke to Addy Engels, who was one of the direct sportives, who was obviously in the car when Jan Boven, his colleague, answered the call of nature. And we also heard from Primoz Roglic himself, didn't we?
Well, we'll hear first from Antoine Tolhoek, who was on hand to give him the bike when Roglic had a problem. Then we'll hear from Addy the Engels. We can see Primoz seems very calm, always. What was he like yesterday in the moment when you needed to swap bikes with him?
It was really fast. I think we only meet like 43 seconds. I give him my bike and I push him away. So that was our meeting yesterday.
Were you more sort of panicked, stressed out in that situation than he was?
No, I think it's so short time that you cannot be in panic or just not your reaction. You see your leader at the side of the road and yeah, you swap bike and you push him further.
And the calmness that we see in him, is that what he's like all the time?
Yeah, this is how I know Primoz and. He's always like this.
Of course, the moments before was really long and hectic with the climb of Kisalo, descent, immediate climb of Sormano, lots of guys dropping, very tricky and dangerous descent towards the lake. So a long time without a possibility to stop. And coming down at the lake, we provided Primoz with bottles. He had to do it. He was alone in that group, so it was a good moment also for bottles, because the moment we supplied him with the bottles, all the other teams got called to supply the bottles as well. And because of that, also knowing that we wouldn't be able to stay in position because all the other teams had to supply their riders, and the road was of course not very wide. So knowing that we weren't possible to, it wasn't possible to stay in position for a short while, we decided to take that opportunity and to make a quick stop because it was needed. And then at that moment, of course, the worst timing possible. Exactly when we get back into the car and we move up, we hear that Primoz needs a new bike.
What did you feel when you heard that?
It's like I can't say that, but how on earth is this possible at this moment? I mean, nothing happens. We do it like all the time, so, you know, not to try to get away with it. I mean, in the end, it was a mistake. I'm very clear about that. But of course, you think, how on earth is this possible that exactly at this moment this strikes? But okay, then, like Primoz said, did you know what was happening? No, of course, that's not the moment to tell what's going on. It's just to be as efficient as possible at that moment. and to say, yeah, we are not there at the moment, and Antoine is, and you have to take his bike. So,
La Gazzetta dello Sport asked, where did the second bike go, or where did the old bike go? Where did it go?
They asked it also at the finish, and I answered then already that it was on the roof of the second race car, because Antoine gave his bike to Primoz. We passed Antoine because we had to help Primoz and to support him. So Antoine, unfortunately, was left in the middle of nowhere with a broken bike of Primoz. And then, in the end, he got his spare bike from the second race car. I also want to say that when the second car of Movistar passed, they helped him. And he did I don't know how far, but he did a couple of kilometers on a spare bike of Movistar.
Has he been fined for that, or no, he hasn't had a time penalty? Is that because the commissaires didn't know?
In the end, I don't know if they knew or not, because they also said, also Movistar, I think, said, yeah, okay, we will inform the commissaires about it. That, I mean, it's the race is not being won or lost there. So, but if he didn't get fined, but if he would, I think, it would be according to the rules to fine. But I think, it was in terms of helping each other, a gesture. It's, on the other hand, I think it would be unfair also to fine Antoine and Movistar as well. So, but in the end, he changed to his own spare bike. And I think the broken bike of Primoz, which was taken first by Movistar, went then to the roof of the second race car, which was at the bus parking like every day, and which was driven away by one of the mechanics to the hotel after everything was done, like we do every day. So
did it arrive very late in the bus parking?
It was behind our last riders, so behind the croupetto. So I don't know exactly how late. I was doing a lot of interviews. I don't get the commotion, to be honest. I mean, the bike was there. I mean, so it's not true that they say that the bike didn't arrive at the bus parking or whatever. I also don't want to waste too much energy on it, but I mean, yeah, you also have to be correct on the facts, and they were not. The bike was there. They asked me, I answered them. So they probably didn't believe me.
Yeah. And just lastly on Primoz, Adi, if you look at yesterday and you know climb like yesterday, you'd say that if Primoz had the legs that he had at the start of the Giro, he would have been able to stay with those guys, probably drop them. So the obvious conclusion is that he's over the plateau and he's not as good as he was at the start of the Giro. Is that fair?
No, I don't think that's an obvious conclusion. It's a conclusion about yesterday. And I think, like he was saying, I was not having the best day. On the last climb yesterday, he wasn't as good as he was before. Also, don't underestimate the power he had to spend to get back to the group after the bike change with Antoine. I think he paid in the end, also because all day he felt not good, like he said, a little bit the stomach. So, but I really think it's something about yesterday. The day before, he was still going strong, and I think yesterday was just not a good day for our team in terms of everything. And we have a good rest day so far, and I'm sure he will be ready to fight from tomorrow.
Do you think you're going to win it?
Yes. yeah, I do. I mean, if I lose that, then I have to go home. Then I can't do my job properly, and I really think we can, and we'll try to make the best plan every day as possible. And then, of course, in the end, it comes down to a few decisive moments where Primoz has to deliver.
The fastest clothing in the World Tour, the home of cycling with character. Ride and watch with Rafa in 2019 as they partner with EF Education First and Canyons Run.
A big thank you to Rafa, who sponsor the Cycling Podcast. They're our headline sponsor, and they've supported us since 2016, enabling us to cover the Giro and the other Grand Tours. Rafa have launched their Aero range of clothing, which has been developed in the wind tunnel, looking at all the things that make clothing go faster. The range includes an Aero jersey for men and women, Aero suits for men and women, and pro team bib shorts. These garments are exactly the same as those being worn by the EF Education First team in this Giro d'Italia. Rafa's Aero range has been developed for years to save you seconds. Check out the full range at rafa.cc. So, Daniel, this is our press conference. Shall we just get straight into your questions?
Yes, Rich. The latest from our position on the terrace overlooking Lago di Zeo is that Mattia Cattaneo has had enough to eat now, and he's been replaced by Dario Cataldo, who's tucking in himself.
Oh, Dario.
Who's finished polishing off the last crisps that Cattaneo didn't wolf down.
I'm not sure if crisps are good for cats, are they?
Well, I don't know.
We'll soon find out.
Hi, this is Gergely speaking from Hungary. I have a question about sprinting. In the last couple of sprint stages of the Giro d'Italia, we have seen that the sprinters have been jumping from wheel to wheel. And I would like to ask you the question, how do sprinters communicate with their teams and their lead out men? Is there any sort of talking going on while they are sprinting? Or is it completely based on how they feel and what they do? And already speaking in during sprinting is kind of hard with the efforts that they are producing. And the other thing is, of course, how do they communicate so that other teams don't understand them? I love the show. Keep up the good work, and thank you very much.
Well, there's certainly a lot of shouting that goes on. We've seen footage, thanks to Velon and other people inside the bunch. And I do remember footage of a sprint finish, possibly the Tour of Switzerland, involving John Degenkolb, and a lot of shouting, but I'm not sure I would call it communication.
No, I think that's the only option open to them, though, isn't it, Rich? And obviously, shouting from behind, so the sprinter can probably communicate with the lead-out man. The lead-out man probably can't communicate with the sprinter, certainly in the last 500 metres or so, simply because, you know, he's not going to turn his head and his voice isn't going to carry backwards.
Nice to have a caller from Hungary, and Gergely says that there's been a lot of sprinters jumping from wheel to wheel, and it's been quite chaotic, and there haven't been many kind of smooth lead outs, and that's absolutely right. But I think that sprinters are always acting on their instincts, aren't they? And that's what makes them good sprinters. You know, a lot of them now practice lead outs and so on, but you can only practice lead outs without other lead out trains and other riders around you. And it's that extra variable that makes sprints so difficult. And the best sprinters are the ones like Mark Cavendish, who, you know, when you watch an aerial shot, it's almost like he is seeing that aerial shot, and that he can see where riders are coming from behind him, to the sides of him. Now we've got a cat sitting on a keyboard. Well, this is very off-putting, isn't it? But we'll try. But that's the talent, isn't it, of the sprinter, that kind of peripheral vision.
Yes, Richard, although I would suggest that it's an area that could be explored to a greater extent by teams, and will be explored to a greater extent by teams. I don't know whether we'll see kind of full-scale, bunch sprint simulations at training camps. I don't know how you'd pull such a thing off. But, when you speak to sprinters these days, often they're quite sort of nonchalant and quite matter-of-fact about how they practice their sprinting, when they practice their sprinting. You know, you hear about lead-out practices at sort of training camps, but, you know, only on two or three occasions a year will a kind of lead out train get together and really do sort of dry runs, kind of rehearsal of their sprint train.
Shall we move on to the next question?
Morning, guys. I've been really enjoying your coverage of the Giro, particularly the cultural insights to Italy that you provide. I'd like to know which region of Italy produces the best cyclists currently and historically. Thanks very much. This is Rob from Glasgow.
Thanks, Rob from Glasgow. That sounds like a question for Daniel.
Well, Rich, there's always been a sort of holy trinity or a triangle of great cycling regions in Italy. That's the Veneto, so the region around Venice that stretches sort of from Venice to Verona, and then Lombardy, where we are now, Rich. So that's the Milan region, and it goes all the way up north to the Swiss border. And the third region is Tuscany. And that still holds true today. It's always been the case. There's always been a sort of smattering of professionals from other regions. There are professionals who have come from the southern regions and they migrate in their teens. Vincenzo Nibali, for example, lived or spent most of his teenage years in Tuscany. And there hasn't really been much change on that score. Currently, if you look at the kind of best Italian riders, they're pretty spread around. I mean, you've got Nibali, who's an adopted Tuscan. Bettiol won the Tour of Flanders. He's from Tuscany. But it's not quite, Tuscany is not quite as strong as it was in the 90s when there were the likes of Taffi, Chandri, Ballerini, Bartoli, Bettini. That was really the heyday of for Tuscany. Yeah, those three regions are the main ones.
It's funny how, I mean, Italy is a very regionalized country, isn't it? And it was staggering to learn that Valerio Conti was the first rider from Rome ever to wear the pink jersey.
It is extraordinary. And it was also extraordinary that prior to Danilo De Luca winning in 2007, no rider from the south of Italy, from south of Rome, had ever won the Giro. And even De Luca was from Abruzzo, which is really in the centre. So the only real southern winner of the Giro d'Italia to date, and the Giro started in 1909, was Vincenzo Nibali.
Hey guys, it's Graham Campbell here, calling from Belfast in Northern Ireland. I'm a long-time listener of the Cycling Podcast, and I've always wondered how your daily Grand Tour podcasts are produced. After you've spent a long day driving from location to location, interviewing riders and team staff, sampling the local cuisine, how do you put together the podcast at the end of each day? Have you much of a production team in Italy? Is there much material left on the cutting room floor? Is there much pressure to get the podcast out before the end of each day? Thanks, and keep up the good work.
Hey, Richard, Daniel, and Lionel. It's Tim calling. I normally live in Beijing, but I'm visiting the US this week. And I noticed on Sunday evening that the episode for the time trial stage dropped at about 6 p.m. Eastern time, which is midnight in Italy, if I do my math correctly. And I was wondering if, without breaking any trade secrets, you could tell us a little bit about the background to making the daily podcasts, how you record them, when they get edited, how they get dropped, because it seems like there's some heroic efforts that go on late into the night to make sure that we, your listeners, stay up to date as quickly as possible. I really appreciate it. I'm going to listen to the latest episode now.
Well, thanks, Graham and Tim, for we played those questions together because they're similar, I guess. The truth is that while the hard work has been done on the episode, we're having dinner, aren't we? We record as early as possible. That's a nice bell, isn't it?
Lovely.
Very ghostly, haunting, isn't it, with the clouds and the...
Yeah, lovely haunting mist over the lake.
It's a beautiful scene. Anyway... We record as soon as we can after the stage, after the interviews that we've done at the finish and around the buses, and then we usually sit in the press conference and we gather our thoughts and sit down, usually over a drink, and record the podcast. We then upload our audio files to Dropbox. We have a team of excellent producers. We should mention them all at this point. Jonathan Rowe is producing this. Jonathan does lots besides producing, but he is one of our excellent producers. We've also got Tom Wally, Adam Bowie, Will Jones, Paul Scoynes, Alex Adey. They are our team of excellent producers, and they do a great job. We have a sort of rota.
Not all at once. They don't all produce at once. I got an email from Lance Armstrong last year, or a message saying, "Oh, is it true that your podcast has 10 producers?" I said, "Well, not every day."
I hope we didn't share too many trade secrets with him.
No.
Controversial. But no, they do a great job. I mean, we like to think we don't give them too much to do in terms of editing, but inevitably there are a few little wrinkles to be ironed out. But they do that, and you know, when it comes to Kilometre Zeros especially, they're quite a creative exercise, and we're usually working on them over a few days, and we try to give as detailed instructions as possible for how the episode should be put together. But when it comes to use of music and so on, that's the producers. And, you know, we've got a couple of producers who have a lot of experience working with music on music radio, for example, and they're excellent. Tom Wally is very experienced in the use of music, so he does a lovely job. But they're all really good, and we're very grateful to them. Did I mention John Mooney as well? I don't know if I mentioned John in that list, because John Mooney is one of our regular and, in fact, our original producers, because he was the guy that got us started back in 2013, and really, we couldn't do without any of them.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton, cycling podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
That's Seb Piquet, race radio at the Tour de France, interrupting our Giro coverage to remind me to tell you that this episode is sponsored by Ordnance Survey. If you're planning an adventure in the UK, use the award-winning Ordnance Survey maps. For just £2.99 a month, you can get all the Ordnance Survey maps for the whole of Great Britain across all your devices, and you can even print them out too if you prefer to have a paper copy. You can find new walking, cycling and running routes or create your own. You can view drone-like footage of your routes with 3D fly-throughs. You can explore what's around you with augmented reality. And as I said, you can download and print the maps before you go, so you don't need to worry about whether you've got a phone signal if you're exploring somewhere remote. Now, Daniel, if you were anything like me as a child, when I was just discovering cycling, maps played a hugely important part in getting out and finding the countryside around me, and buying the paper Ordnance Survey maps and laying them out on the dining room table and plotting my routes was a really key part of my cycling learning, and maps play a huge part in that today.
Well, it's very apt that we should be talking about this, the Giro, Lionel, because the Giro is almost, well, famous certainly among journalists for its maps. And there was the Giro has always really had an official cartographer, and there's one gentleman in particular who's really marked the history of the Giro, Cesare Sangalli, who was the official cartographer of the Giro for 50 years. He used to use a quill and ink. Was very particular about the kind of ink he used, and it's something the Giro has always taken very seriously, and they've produced these, you know, these maps that which are objects of great beauty.
Well, they have a house style, don't they? And you can say exactly the same about Ordnance Survey. If you showed me an Ordnance Survey from sort of 50 paces, I think I'd be able to tell you that it was, a Land Ranger. They've got their own distinct look, and not just that, but they're, you know, it's the accuracy of them as well, isn't it? And you kind of learn what all the symbols mean. You look at the key on the back and work out what everything is. You mentioned the Giro and, you know, the kind of the misleading aspect of some of their mapping, you know, leaving off the severity of climbs to maybe hoodwink the rider into thinking the course is not as difficult as it actually is. Ordnance Survey wouldn't do that, because obviously accuracy is their watchword. If you want to get a free 7-day trial, go to osmaps.uk, or you can download at the App Store, or sign up and pay £2.99 a month, and you can get all of the Ordnance Survey maps on your devices.
Okay, Daniel, we've had a question from a listener in Not Watford, and I think I have to read this one out. On my flight home today, I didn't think I needed to visit the bathroom until the captain announced we were preparing to land and switched on the seatbelt sign. Instead of descending to land, we circled over Luton Airport for 20 minutes or so. All of a sudden, I was bursting and wished I had a Jumbo Visma bidon to hand. Fortunately, I managed to hold on, but it was very close. What should I do in future to avoid possible disaster? I think that is a question for you, Daniel.
I think that my pretty scathing comments about the Jumbo Visma director's lack of restraint last night were edited out at my request.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
I didn't know that.
Yeah, they were.
Back to the last question, doesn't it? Any regrets or lingering doubts about something we've said?
Yeah, I don't really suffer from this problem, so I find it hard to empathise with people who you know, who are in this particular predicament.
I find it hard to empathize with people.
Well, yeah.
Hello, Cycling Podcast. This is Eric from Rockford, Michigan in the U.S., proud home of Brent Bookwalter of Mitchelton Scott. My question is, what do you believe professional cycling should be doing better to market or portray the personalities of its riders? It seems as though cycling should not have this problem because of how rich the diversity is in the pro peloton. But oftentimes, the larger cycling media seem more concerned with the latest tech than the human aspects of the Grand Tours. I do appreciate your approach and the insight we get from your interviews with guys such as with Joe Dombrowski. Keep up the good work.
I think this is a really interesting question, because I personally am most interested in the people in the sport. And it's the thing that's always interested me most. And I think you've touched on this, Daniel, a bit. In terms of relating to the riders, getting to know them, and understand them. A big factor is helmets and sunglasses. And when we started following cycling in the 80s, you
speak
could
for yourself.
You could see them in the raw.
I wasn't born in the 80s. <as they were. laughs> Yeah.
No, but there's an issue there, I think, in terms of the sunglasses and the helmets, which, to my annoyance, they come out of the buses wearing those in the mornings, you know, and they come and they meet fans around the buses wearing their helmets and their glasses, and it just makes them slightly invisible in a way. And what I have noticed, it's interesting that the listener Eric there mentions Joe Dombrowski, because Joe Dombrowski is a guy that we've featured quite a lot in the podcast, and I think people feel like they've got to know who he is. And it's been interesting at this Giro, we had a kilometer zero in the second week with Cesare Benedetti, the Bora Hansgrohe rider, who most people wouldn't have really known anything about. And through the episode, I think people felt like they got to know him a little bit. He came across as a very likable, down-to-earth guy. When he was in the break a day or so later and he won the stage, we got an awful lot of feedback from people saying they'd been really rooting for him because they felt this connection with him. They felt like they knew who he was. And that just tells me that, unfortunately, in a bunch of 180-odd riders, most of the riders are unknown to people. People don't know who they are. They don't feel a connection, an affinity with them. And I don't know how you get over that, because it is a sport with lots of people, you know, teams of 30-odd riders. There's a calendar that's just bursting with races. And so how you... especially with these limitations of, I think, the helmets and the glasses, how you get people to know and really relate to the personalities is a real challenge.
I don't know. My opinion on this would be slightly different in that I would compare it to other professional sports, and I would say that cycling kind of leverages its personalities really well, just by the nature of it and by, by virtue of who they are and what their backgrounds are. Generally, cycling tends to attract, I wouldn't say oddballs, but people who have sort of taken a different route at a certain point in their adolescence. They've kind of turned 45 degrees away from the mainstream sports, and they've done something that requires a lot of sacrifice, a lot of hard work. And I think generally it attracts some interesting people. And generally, I think over the course of their careers, those stories are told somewhere, somehow. And I think cycling is quite lucky in that respect. And I still think that we get fantastic access, much better than most mainstream sports. Some of our colleagues sometimes lament that the access isn't what it was. I don't really agree with that. I think that things like press officers, for example, have actually facilitated our work. And I think it's one of the joys of cycling. You can always do more, but I mean, even some of the teams now, in their sort of social media content and the films they're producing, are actually doing a really good job of sort of introducing riders and personalities. And I think sometimes the problem is that there's so much of it that some of it gets lost. And we're almost kind of saturated now with good, interesting content.
On stage 7, Barry Merida set a hard pace to bring back what they claim was a dangerous breakaway. But was it just a coincidence that it spelled the end of Laurence de Prusse's Giro? Not sure if I saw that possibility mentioned anywhere.
Okay, that was a question from Bienyamu. I think that's the correct pronunciation. I hope it is. Daniel, any thoughts on that?
Well, Rich, I asked, guess who I asked today, whether that might have been the case? Adi the Engels. On that day when Lawrence was, when he did pull out, I think Bahrain rode quite hard on the front. You don't think that other teams were trying to eliminate him, do you?
No, I don't think so. I think Bahrain was going fast at that moment, but they were chasing quite a big breakaway that went. And no, I totally understand that they were chasing that breakaway. It was a big, dangerous group, in my opinion, as well. And we weren't able to chase it. I think UAE was having trouble at that moment to chase it, so I think Bahrain took its responsibility, but I think... I guess it was really to chase down the break and not to eliminate Laurence.
So that was Adi the Engels, the DS, of course, Adi Engels from Jumbo-Visma, hopefully shedding a bit of light on that. Next question.
Hi, Alan Mackey here, long-time friend of the podcast, with a question for the rest day press conference. Given the minor beef between Nibali and Roglic this year, which has captured a lot of column inches, I was wondering if there's ever been any proper wars of words in cycling that have really taken off and become bitter. And are there any riders in the current pro peloton that you know of that are particularly hostile towards one another? Keep up the good work, guys, and we need more Giro this year.
More Giro. Well, I think we will be getting more Giro, won't we, this week, for sure, because we're down to two. Lionel has flown home. Well, I mean, there's a long history of hostility and rivalry. Maybe not always hostility, but we're in the land of, you know, Italy. Bartoli and Coppi was one of the early great rivalries, but as much because they were such different people and personalities as because of any sort of enmity between them. Nibali's had quite a lot of beef over the years with different people. Chris Froome, he's had a lot of beef with Chris Froome. There's the alleged confrontation on the Astana bus a few years ago at the Tour de France when Chris Froome stormed onto the bus to confront Nibali. What's Dario Cataldo doing now? As long as he's not chewing, through those cables. Anyway, keep an eye on that. Greg LeMond and Bernardino in the 1986 Tour de France. It's often because there's a clash of personalities or different character types. But currently, I mean, Peter Sagan and Mark Cavendish don't really see eye to eye, do they?
Slightly unilateral, I would suggest. And that all stems from the tangle they had. Which year was it, Rich? 2017 Tour de France, and they've never fully patched things up. The Giro has been famous for beef, really. Moser and Saronni in the late 70s and early 80s, they had several sort of spats in the media. A bit of a humdinger was in 2006 between Gilberto Simoni and Ivan Basso. And that led to, a real confrontation on the morning of the last stage, where Rai TV tried to kind of engineer a truce between them. And Simoni was upset at the way Basso had ridden the previous day. Simoni thought that they had an agreement that they were going to ride to the finish together. Basso ended up dropping him, and yes, he wasn't happy. He then sort of suggested, he made comments that were kind of laden with connotations about doping, and as they turned out, pretty accurate. He said that Basso was like someone from another planet. The next morning, the morning of the last stage, Rai TV tried to engineer a truce, and Simoni basically shoved the microphone in Basso's face and said, "I don't need you, Basso. Sod off," basically. And and that rumbled on for a few years post Simone's retirement, and I think only fairly recently they started to talk again. There have been a few. Nibali's quite a divisive figure in the peloton, popular among the Italians. I would suggest not terribly popular among some English speakers, who shall remain nameless.
Armstrong and Pantani as well, of course. The furor over Armstrong gifting Pantani the stage to Mont Ventoux in 2000 didn't go down so well with Pantani when Armstrong said that he gifted it to him, and there was quite a sort of war of words between them. And it's part of the rich tapestry of the sport, isn't it? Shall we hear the next question?
Hello, Cycling Podcast. This is Stephen Moon from Science in Sports. I've got a question for the press conference tomorrow, and this one's aimed at Daniel. I went out for my morning bike ride today, and it went on a while, and I suddenly realised it was lunchtime. I stopped in Frith Street near Bar Italia, where I know you guys record from, and then I found myself in an existential crisis. I wanted a cappuccino, but it was gone 11 o'clock, and then I found myself messing around saying, can I have a latte? And in the end, I crumbled in indecision and had a double espresso and cycled lamely home, tail between the legs. So my question for Daniel is, does the latte have the same tightly confined time bands that the cappuccino does? I have to know this because I need to go out again for a bike ride tomorrow. So please, Daniel, help me.
A technical question there from Stephen Moon, who's the chief executive at our sponsor, Science and Sport. Nice to hear from you, Stephen. Sorry to hear about the existential crisis. Hope that doesn't affect
us. I'm not terribly sorry. I think that's been my goal all along, to sow seeds of confusion and consternation.
Well, what's the answer to
any milky coffee? Perfectly valid question. The convention is that you don't really have milky coffees after about 11 o'clock, apart from a macchiato, which you can get away with pretty much any time of day.
Macchiato's okay, because I've been doing that.
Macchiato is just a drop of frothy milk in your espresso. Be careful, though, if you go to Germany. Never ask for a latte in Germany, because latte means something else in Germany, something sexual. You have to ask for a latte macchiato.
That could lead to
Germany.
A real existential crisis.
It could.
The Cycling Podcast at the Giro d'Italia is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Oh, what an appropriate time to hear about Science and Sport, who support the Cycling Podcast. We're very grateful to them. Very grateful to Stephen Moon, who is a great supporter. We're very lucky with our main sponsors, Rafa and Science and Sport, because Simon Mottram at Rafa and Stephen Moon at Science and Sport are fantastic supporters who I know both listen to the podcast, and we hear from them pretty regularly. Not usually, or not often, with complaints occasionally, obviously. But I'm very grateful to them. And if you want Science and Sport products, you can get 25% off all your sports nutrition products with the code SISCP25 at scienceandsport.com. So fill your boots with gels, bars, drinks, and so on. And thank you once again to Science and Sport. We move on to the next question.
Okay, hi, this is David Campion, and I'm a long-term fan of the podcast, and my question concerns team dimension data. If you hadn't spoken to Scott Davis, I wouldn't have known that dimension data was riding the Giro. Their roster includes a large number of veteran riders, and I'm wondering whether they're relying too much on the old guard. Are they in danger of losing their world tour status due to their lack of results? The other thing I was wondering is, what's happened to Michael Balcon? I'm interested to know what you guys think. Thank you.
Well, David, thank you very much for your question. Sorry about the line there. A bit of a story behind that, but I'll not bore you with it now. But I'm glad you were able to get your question in, David. I will bore you with it. He actually phoned me by mistake because I'd emailed him and he had my number, and because he'd been trying to get through in the WhatsApp number. Couldn't manage that, so he phoned me and I just recorded him as I was standing at the finish yesterday waiting for the riders to come in. So I'm glad you were able to get your question, David. It's a good question about dimension data. They have been one of, you know, two or three teams that have really not done anything at this Giro d'Italia, and that's been the story of the last couple of seasons for dimension data. You're right that they have some quite veteran experienced riders, but they've also got some very young riders. They've got a mixture really of veteran riders and really young inexperienced riders. They don't really have many here in that kind of sweet spot of, you know, being at the kind of peak of their careers, I guess. Now, they did bring in over the winter some experienced, Roman Kreuziger, Gasparotto, who's here, Michael Valgren, who's
Lars Back,
and Michael Valgren, who you mentioned, who should be at the prime of his career, looked fantastic last year. You know, won a couple of classics, was very good at World Championships, and he was a real marquee signing for them, and has not performed at all this year. He was unwell apparently in the spring, but it kind of happens, doesn't it, when a team is in this downward spiral, that a rider like Valgren can move there and vanish, we hope, temporarily.
Yeah, I think there are two problems there. One is a collective problem, a question of momentum, confidence, the sort of vibe in the team maybe of the last few months. There are other problems that are very much kind of individualized. I think Valgren had issues with training, maybe trained too hard in the winter. Louis Meintjes is another high-profile rider on that team who moved to, well, it was at the start of last year, wasn't it, and has never really got going there. He had issues with, I think he lost too much weight in his previous team and has just never really got up and running at Dimension Data. Cavendish has had his own problems. And they've also kind of fought with the issue of whether to load their team with their best riders at certain races and send very weak teams to other races that are happening at the same time, or whether to sort of hedge their bets across two races. And they haven't really found the perfect balance on that yet. But they desperately need some wins. They desperately need some momentum.
Yeah, Ben O'Connor came to this Giro having performed really well last year until he crashed out with a broken collarbone towards the end. But again, this has not been a season of progression for him, and he's struggling. And so I noticed Doug Ryder, the boss at Dimension Data, was here at the race a couple of days ago. So maybe we'll try and speak to him before the end of the Giro.
Hi guys, friend of the podcast, Michael here from Dublin. I have a question about Esteban Chavez, both short-term and a long-term one. In the short-term in this Giro, do you think he's here to ride into some kind of super domestique form in week three, or does he simply not have enough race days in his legs for that yet? And then in the longer-term, do you feel he's likely to stay on at Mitchelton Scott? I think this is the last year of his contract. And if so, what do you think his role there is going to be? Is he still good enough to get to be to one of the three GC leaders with the Yates brothers, or is he now more likely to be that week three climbing domestique? Thanks. Keep up the good work. Enjoying the show. Bye.
So, Rich, a lot of people had questions about Chavez before this Giro, and what I do know is that he is fully healthy again, and Mitchelton's got very happy about that. There is absolutely no reason for him not to be performing the way he was 2 or 3 years ago, at least from a health perspective. I think he's had a few little issues with his weight. I mean, it's all relative when we're talking about professional cyclists. We're talking about maybe he's 2 or 3 kilos heavier than he was when he was, almost winning the Giro 3 years ago. But I think Mitchelton Scott expects him to improve in the third week and to be very useful to Simon Yates. He is in the last year of his contract. He came into this Giro really, I don't think, knowing what he's going to do next year. I don't think Mitchelton Scott knew what kind of offer they were going to make him if they were indeed going to try to keep him on board. I'm still not sure what the situation is. I would guess this is the second day of the Giro. It wouldn't shock me if there were conversations happening today about that particular issue.
Speaking of which, Daniel, on the transfer rumour front, a little birdie tells me that Richard Carapaz, the current leader at the Giro, could well be on his way from Movistar, may well have agreed to join another team out contract at the end of the year.
Who?
Richard Carapaz. The rumour I hear is a team that's got quite famously deep pockets, and that an agreement may well have been hatched last year, but we'll maybe investigate that one a little bit further.
Was Rob Hatch your
source? Rob Hatch hasn't been involved in this transfer, no.
I think you've given away your source.
Just a question about Chavez. I mean, it's funny how, we were talking about how fickle we all are and how quickly somebody disappears from view. It is remarkable to think that only 3 years ago he almost won the Giro. He came within a day of winning the Giro. I mean, can we see him contending? And that same year, was he not third at the Vuelta as well? He was on the podium at the Giro and the Vuelta that year. Can we see him contending to win a Grand Tour again, do you think?
I think, again, I would just sort of defer to what people in the team are saying. And he's healthy again. He had glandular fever. I think all of his kind of values are normal again now. I think, he probably has to regain a bit of confidence, lose a little bit of weight, get a full Grand Tour under his belt, which hopefully will in this Giro, and then who knows. But the sport moves on quickly, doesn't it? I mean, we keep hearing this year, for whatever reason, the level has gone up again. Guys can be left behind as well. I don't think that's necessarily the case, or will be the case in with Chavez, but I think he can. I think he's someone who will be a factor in the mountains in major tours for the next 3 or 4 years.
Ciao, Richard, Lionel and Daniel. This is Patrick from rural Bedfordshire, long-time listener, first-time caller. I'm interested to know your thoughts on the balance of this year's route, as after a weekend of fabulous racing, the long, boring sprint stages seem a distant memory. Have the Giro organisers played a blinder by creating a route that has a slow burn effect, or should future Grand Tour planners look to add tricky stages in amongst the flat sprint ones? What makes a good Grand Tour excellent from looking at the stage profile alone? Many thanks and keep up the good work, Patrick.
Thanks, Patrick. It's an interesting question that I mentioned in the answer to the last question about memories being very short, and we do tend to judge a race by how it ends, if you like. I mean, it happens in one-day races as well. The Amstel Gold Race was hailed as one of the greatest races ever seen, when actually I think only the finale was really exciting and enthralling. And it's the same with Grand Tours. I mean, the 1989 Tour de France, maybe not a great example because it was actually a very close battle throughout, so I don't know why I mentioned that. But, you know, when races are very close and come down to the wire, a better example, 2008 Tour de France, when there were four riders in contention going into the final time trial and everybody was getting very excited about that. But nobody now looks on that race as a classic, partly because of the riders who were in contention. And again, that's a factor too. It's the calibre of the riders who are contending that you know, determines whether the race goes down as a classic or not. But I do think that an exciting final week, a real backloaded race can airbrush out the boring early stages, and in some ways seem even more exciting because there's been this kind of such a long prelude to the real action.
Yeah, I always try to think in terms of the duration of the drama and the suspense, and, you know, how many hours in a stage race is the real uncertainty about what the outcome's going to be, or the outcome even of that particular stage. In this race, it looks as though, relatively speaking, we're going to have a lot of hours of suspense and drama and interest. However, you know, I also found myself arguing with someone the other day about, you know, the best classics, the most interesting classics. And, you know, I always make a strong case for Milan-San Remo. A lot of people hate it. And that runs completely counter to my argument that, you know, the drama there lasts a few seconds. But it's very intense drama, and it's also completely predictable. You know exactly what kind of drama is going to unfold, when it's going to unfold, and it takes about 10 or 15 minutes. So, you know, there are no sort of hard and fast rules. There are other factors that also come into it. The route, you know, how interesting is the route? How beautiful is it? How much does the race capture the imagination of the public? What kind of rivalries play out? What kind of sort of controversies play out? So I think it's a pretty complex, multi-layered tapestry.
Do we have time for one more question?
Hello, Daniel, Richard and Lionel. It's Brad here in Melbourne, Australia. And I just had a question for the press conference, and it was actually about the Tour de France. I this year hope to attend a stage in the third week, I think it is, just outside Toulouse. There is a mountain stage, which I just happen to be not far away from. And I'm wondering practically how difficult it is to get up to a mountain top finish, or even the top of a mountain climb. You know, how early you have to go, how bad the traffic becomes, you know, before they actually then close the road, how early they close the road, those sort of practical things, just trying to plan how we will get up to the top of a mountain stage. Really enjoy the podcast. Thanks very much, guys.
Thanks, Brad. Actually, I've got some things to say about this, because I've been relatively recently to the Tour de France as a spectator. Daniel's always had an accreditation badge swinging around his neck, so he's been in the bubble, so to speak. But before I do, Daniel, you were telling me a very interesting thing today as we were driving through some of the rougher parts of the suburbs of Bergamo about the start in Toulouse this year of the Tour de France.
Yes, there has been a bit of an effort this year to sort of restore, give back the Tour de France to a different demographic in France. The image that the Tour de France often projects of France, the country, is kind of a sort of folkloric, idyllic world of sort of bunting and tricolour flags and, you know, people with onions around their neck. And you know, that reflects, that mirrors La France profonde, a certain type of France, a certain facet of French life, but certainly not all of France.
Anyway,
there's a group of school children in Toulouse, in one of the less affluent parts of Toulouse, shall we say, who have kind of lobbied for the Tour de France to visit their area of the city. And they sent letters to Macron, the Prime Minister, and he has fully supported the bid. He spoke to Christian Prudhomme, and they've sort of got together and they've made it happen. So the start in Toulouse this year, I forget the name of the exact area, and it's not going to start in the heart of, I think it's a council estate to all intents and purposes, but it will start very close to there. And it's, I mean, I spoke to Christian Prudhomme about it at the tour, the Yorkshire, and he's certainly very excited about this. It's not the first time the Tour de France has been to an area like that, but it's the first time in a while.
Yeah, that'll be interesting. I mean, Toulouse is a very beautiful city, but like a lot of very beautiful cities in France, some of the outskirts are less salubrious, and there have been quite a few problems around Toulouse in recent years. So that is an initiative that's definitely worth keeping an eye on. And in terms of visiting the race, I mean, some of our listeners may have better tips than this, but the last time I went as a spectator was 2004, and I went to Toulouse, actually, and stayed in Toulouse, and then got myself up with some friends to the summit of Plateau de Bay the next day, and we just drove up in a rental car, and we went and stayed close to the bottom of the mountain the night before, and then went up about 9 o'clock in the morning before the roads were closed. Now, I don't know if that has changed more recently, because they've certainly cracked down on cars going up and cyclists going up as well, which is a real problem. A lot of people cycle to see the tour in the mountains, and then at the bottom of climbs get stopped and told to walk up with their bikes. So that can be an issue if that's what you're planning to do. But we were able to drive to the top of the mountain and park and watch the race. Take food, take drink, including water, and have a great day. I think it's a fantastic way to spend a day. And, you know, that moment when you see the helicopters appearing in the valley below, coming towards you very, very slowly, it's tremendously exciting. And it's not something we often experience, unfortunately, as journalists, really, because we're in the press room and then at the finish. But it's great. It's a great way to spend a day.
Yeah, I think the key there is probably just to try to gather as much information as you can in the days before the race. You can pepper us with messages on Twitter. We might answer. We tend to be quite busy in the Tour de France, but we might have some information about when the roads are going to be closed. If not, look at the local press. Just ask people, because it does vary quite a lot. There are some climbs which close a day before the race. Some climbs you can ride all the way up quite happily, quite easily. It's quite difficult to give kind of blanket advice,
but it's perhaps not as difficult as some people imagine to see it and to have a really good day. Interesting. We had a response, actually. You were asked, I think, in the last press conference, you and Lionel, about which was the Grand Tour you recommended people to go and watch, and you recommended the Giro, and there's loads of really good reasons for that. But one listener got in touch to say that they felt very strongly that the Tour is the race to go and see, because it's a Tour, you know. And if you're a spectator and you want to sort of immerse yourself in the just the sheer scale and the buzz that's around the Tour, it is on a different level to the Giro, which also, of course, makes it much more difficult to get close to and to see. And at the Giro here, we've met quite a few podcast friends at starts, and it's incredibly open. You know, at the Tour, you can't get into the paddock with the buses. Here at the Giro, there aren't that many people in some of the paddocks where you can just wander around and speak to the riders. A couple of friends of the podcast yesterday, I chatted to Daniel. They said they'd met you and Matt White, and said how friendly and chatty Matt White was. So anyway, it's lovely to meet people at races, and we do meet quite a lot of people at the Giro because it's so accessible. Should we wrap things up for tonight, Daniel?
Yes, Rich. We've got dinner to get to, haven't we?
Got to send all these files to our wonderful producer, Jonathan, to just, you know, take out all the mistakes and make it sound a bit better, cut out some of my ums and my ahs, and try and piece it all together. So over to you, Jonathan. Thanks very much. We'll be back tomorrow with stage 16.
Yes, and we've got the Mortirolo tomorrow, haven't we?
Oh, must mention your kilometer zero went out today.
We'll just mention it then.
about the Mortirolo, and I haven't actually listened to it yet myself,
no worries,
but it's getting
forgiving.
Really great forgiving. Response from people.
Oh, yeah.
It's been a busy day. Kilometer zero continues Monday, Wednesday, Friday. The next one on Wednesday will be about Primoz Roglic and his team Jumbo Visma.
And good evening from Dario Cataldo. See if we can get a meow out of him.
Dario?
Meow.
Ci gira nella tenevo giardina che la raccolgo con l'acqua e lo vino.